Ready or not, and believe me, the smart money is on not. The 2016 Olympic Games are kicking off this weekend in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. It is hard to overstate the financial impact of the Olympic Games. The last two cities that hosted the Games spent an average of $16.2 billion each. Exclusive broadcaster NBC has brought in about $1 billion in advertising and will probably only break even. Then, of course, there's the giant halo of other costs, from training to sponsorships to wardrobe, like the $1,200 Swarovski crystal-encrusted leotards on the U.S. women's gymnastics team this year. And, of course, all of that is happening in Brazil, where the economy, once powerful, is crashing. There's political corruption, skyrocketing crime, the threat of terrorist attacks, and, of course, the Zika virus. So this week, we'll be taking a look at the Olympics and the Olympic-sized challenges facing this year's Games. Before we get into our Olympic deep dive, you see what I did there? Let's take a look at some of the other business news of the week. We're going to start with a round of long and short. I'm joined by Sam Grobart, senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek, and Raghu Manavalan, producer here at Marketplace. They're going to tell me what they're bearish and bullish on. Hey, guys. Thanks for being here.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey.
Sam, just out of curiosity, what are you long on this week?
I'm long on flossing your teeth, okay? There was a story in the New York Times a couple of days ago that said there's actually no proof that flossing your teeth in any way helps prevent cavities or stave off periodontal disease. And you want to know something? I don't care. I'm going to still floss my teeth because flossing gets food out of your mouth. And if you leave it there, it's gross.
Even if it falls into the category of old wives' tale.
That's right. I'm with it. I like that minty fresh feeling. It makes me feel virtuous. I do it before I go to bed. It's part of a whole ritual. It's really important to me, and I'm not letting it go.
I would just like to know who was behind the study that found that flossing is not as effective as, you know, we think it is. Because does that person actually hate flossing to the point where they spent money on proving its failure?
My understanding was that what they said was that it just hadn't been proved either way.
Hmm.
There's still a chance that floss could come out on top. All right, Raghu, what about you? What are you really feeling good about this week? What are you long on?
Not quite as good as floss, but I am long on the future of daily fantasy sports. If you guys don't know what that is, it's this game where basically you're given like a hypothetical budget and you buy players from around a sport. So you get like, you know, the first baseman for the Yankees, a pitcher for the Dodgers, whatever.
Best exemplified by FanDuel and Sport King,
and
that's the other one, FanDuel and DraftKings.
The two companies that
I should have seen enough commercials.
That's exactly what I was going to say. If you watch any sport, they have their name everywhere now. New York had banned the practice earlier this year, but earlier this week, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo actually put into law that the games can be played in the state, and he expects about $4 million in education funding to be coming from taxing the games.
Yeah, I have to admit, it seemed a little hypocritical to say you can have a lottery. They put them in the category of lottery now, right? Whereas previously they had said it was in the category of gambling, or they needed to figure out the regulations.
The difference
games
between
skill.
Exactly. Now it's being classified as a skill-based competition, or that's what FanDuel and DraftKings are arguing, whereas before it was, you know, gambling or a game of chance or whatever.
Sometimes these benefits to educational programs and so forth seem a little dubious. I know that in some cases a lot of that money doesn't actually wind up where it's supposed to go, so it doesn't always justify the scratchy lottery ticket you can buy at the deli.
Right, but it certainly justifies the press conference to say that after people have been hammering the mayor's office begging for their FanDuel back. But let's move on to the short.
I am short on the old headphone jack. This is the time of year. We're about a month away from when Apple is going to have its big event revealing the new iPhone. And it's expected, according to a lot of the rumors that you see out there, that they're going to do away with the old 3.5 millimeter headphone jack, because that means they can actually make the phone even slimmer. The thinking is that you'll use the existing Lightning port, which you currently use to charge your phone, as a way to connect either an adapter or native Lightning headphones, or you might use wireless headphones using the Bluetooth on the phone. But either way, Apple has always been very sort of unsympathetic about various formats and technologies. And so they say, we're getting rid of the 3.5 inch floppy disk drive. We're getting rid of CD-ROM drives. Well, now this is another one that you can sort of throw on the ash heap.
I want to clarify, because I have a strong opinion here. You are short on the jack itself, not short on the entire ludicrous concept of getting rid of the headphone jack. Probably the feature that I use the single most often on my phone that's not Twitter.
Molly, you've definitely tapped into something out there. Not unlike Donald Trump, there is a discord in this country. And whenever I mention this thing about the headphone jack going away, people are up in arms about it.
You don't have a Bluetooth headset?
Bluetooth doesn't work. You guys, Bluetooth doesn't work. Like, you could make this argument if we had a technology that you could replace it with, but Bluetooth does not work. And if you try to go with your Bluetooth headset from the sidewalk into your car, then I guarantee you're going to die of either rage or a crash trying to figure out why it connected to the car and not the thing in your ear. Just no. How could we even be a divided country on this? Everyone should just be filled with rage. Rugu, what are make us mad about something else.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you want to stop with the rage, I don't know if this is the right topic for me to be bringing up right now. I am short on NBC's coverage of the Olympics. I know they need to make money. I know they need to keep ratings high, but I just feel like they're taking it too far this year. Even though Rio is only an hour ahead of the East Coast, you still have to wait that 1 hour. If you live in Los Angeles or on the West Coast, you have to wait 4 hours. You can't even stream it. I want to share right now how deep the tentacles of big NBC have invaded into these games. They successfully moved swimming events to a later time slot so that it would be live in the United States. That means that some events will be starting after midnight local time in Brazil. That just seems like a silly time to swim. They tried to lobby the United States to be at the end of the opening ceremony because they thought that people would turn it off once they showed the U.S. The IOC said, no, that's just a little too much for us.
Zimbabwe was probably pissed about that, too.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I mean, it's the one thing they get, you know, coming out last.
Right.
We're going to take that away from them now? Come on. Here's a quote by John Miller, NBC's Olympic chief marketing officer during the Olympics. The people who watch the Olympics are not particularly sports fans. More women watch the games than men. And for the women, they're less interested in the result and more interested in the journey. It's sort of like the ultimate reality show and miniseries wrapped into one. And to tell the truth, it has been the complaint of a few sports writers. It has not been the complaint of the vast viewing public.
Yes, I'm verging on the unprofessional here, but I think it is fair to say that NBC has come in for a good deal of mockery over particularly the live streaming of events. I mean, I think at this point, the fact that half of the world will be tweeting about it when the other half is not, I mean, how are we not past that in 2016? I won't even get into the institutionalized discrimination contained in that statement,
especially
as a former sports writer. Rugu Madhavan of Marketplace and Sam Grobart of Bloomberg Businessweek. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Over the next hour, we're going to be looking at Brazil, these Olympics, the good and bad of it all. But of course, behind all those headlines are the people in this economy, those who are affecting and being affected by these huge events. So before we talk more about the Olympics in Brazil, let's meet the people of Brazil by taking a closer look at Rio and its people known as cariocas. What are they like? What are their quirks? What are their habits? Hint, Speedo. From our partners at the BBC, here's Brazil correspondent Jula Caneiro.
It's the middle of winter in Rio, but it's a glorious sunny day on Ipanema Beach. The water crystal clear, the sand packed with people, and the peaks of the Two Brothers Mountain framing the view. I'm from Rio, and I want to tell you a bit about the cariocas, as people born here in Rio are known. Let's see if my fellow cariocas can help me explain.
Comportamento carioca? Desleixado, displicente.
How cariocas act? Relaxed, sloppy, but in the good sense, without a care in the world. If a celebrity walks by, they won't even notice. They're too busy living their lives. The beach is key to understanding the culture of the cariocas. Here on the beach, I see many women with very small bikinis. It's quite normal here. But note that going topless isn't common at all. And the men, well, some are wearing long shorts, but most prefer wearing Speedo-style swimsuits.
I love the carioca accent. I come from São Paulo, and I like how welcoming people here are. They are very warm and friendly, and always greet you with a smile. And they really take good care of their bodies.
I've come to meet Priscila Ann Goslin. She's American, but has been living in Rio for over 30 years. And she's the author of How to Be a Carioca, a book that became a reference on carioca behavior. Priscila, where did this idea come from?
Well, I saw these tourists walking down the beach. I mean, obvious tourists, because the man was wearing socks and sandals. They were neon sign tourists. And under their arm, I remember they were carrying a Portuguese-English dictionary. And I thought, they're never going to understand what's going on. They need to learn the slang. They have to understand what the cariocas are doing. All the customs, like the kissing. You kiss twice, which cheek do you kiss first? The punctuality, or the lack of punctuality, I should say, so that they can really feel the essence of what Rio de Janeiro is all about.
Do you think it's possible for you to summarize the Carioca way of life?
I think that they're incredibly friendly, open. They wear their emotions on their sleeve, which I think is beautiful. You go to a bank or you go someplace to wait in line and you'll start up a conversation with the person in front of you. The person next to you will share the most intimate secrets while you stand in line, and you'll never see this person again, and it doesn't matter. It's just spontaneous.
Friendly, informal, and not very punctual. Time here is somewhat relative. Cariocas are often late.
When you throw a party, for example, if the hour is 9 o'clock, the hour which is set, the host will be in the shower at 9 o'clock. So you shouldn't get there at 9 o'clock.
Gregório do Vivier is an actor, writer, and satirist from Rio, a keen observer of Carioca ways, reflected in the comedy sketches in Porta dos Fundos. This is the famous YouTube channel that he helped create, followed by 12 million people.
It's a vicious circle. I know that people get late, so I get late, and people know that I get late. It's so usual to be late that it's almost fashion, you know? People, I don't know, it's weird to get on time.
I've come to one of the famous samba bars in Lapa, Rio's nightlife district, and I'm sipping a beer by the old Lapa Aqueduct, one of Rio's landmarks. Nothing turns sadness into joy like samba music, another key to understanding the sense of optimism of the cariocas.
Above all, the Carioca is very positive. Even with all the problems we face, the violence, inequality, we look past that and see the bright side of things.
Cariocas face no lack of adversity in this city. Seeing the glass half full might just be our survival strategy.
That was the BBC's Julia Carneiro in Brazil. There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. Now let's talk about the Olympics and the many, many controversies around the games this year. Now, this is not unusual. Every time the Olympics comes around, there's some major problem, but somehow this year still feels different. For one thing, there's a viral pandemic. Health concerns in Rio prompted 200 experts to sign a letter to the World Health Organization asking that the games be moved or postponed. That clearly didn't happen, but NYU professor Lee Eagle was one of the experts who signed that letter. He joins us now. Hi, Lee.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
This isn't the first time that an Olympic Games site has been less than ideal. Why is it so much worse this time around?
So one of the things about what's going on in Rio is that it's really not like any of the other Olympic Games sites that we've come through in the past. And that's because what's going on in Rio now and around Brazil is different. There's some historic turmoil, some historic turbulence in the economy, in the political condition there, and in the social situation. So you take any one of those, not even thinking about all three of them, but take any one of those, put a sports mega event like an Olympic Games in the mix, and you start to wonder where different resources are going to go, human resources, financial resources. Then add to that a severe virus outbreak. We've got Zika virus there, and it really really starts to put questions around where you're going to put those resources. So you look at a place like Rio, where, again, the economics, the politics, the social situation is going on, changing in all sorts of different directions, not for the better, certainly. And it puts a stress on all sorts of systems there, the infrastructure, healthcare, security. So you've got really one of those perfect storms and a truly perfect storm of so many factors that are going on that just make it a very difficult place to have an Olympic Games at this point in time.
So why do you think Zika, even all by itself, wasn't a big enough crisis to warrant either a postponement or a location change?
Zika by itself, there's a lot of writing on the other side of those who signed on to this letter that really says, you know, Zika virus isn't really such a terrible virus that's swirling around, that it is for women who are pregnant or who would become pregnant. And even if you get past some of the things about sexual transmission, it's just not that bad. It's kind of flu-like and you can get over it. One, I'd say talk to people who have suffered from it and they'll tell you a different story. But I think that Zika alone for Brazil really wasn't so much of a concern because Brazil is actually top notch across the world when it comes to eradicating these sorts of viruses that are mosquito borne. And they're pretty good at spraying. They can get the job done and they continuously deal with virus outbreaks. So Brazil, by and large, is very good at it. And so there isn't so much concern on that end. But now start to wrap some of the other factors around it. And it's a whole different story. Again, back to those resources.
What do you think goes into the calculation then? So if they say, you know, look, Zika is mostly flu-like. It's not that serious. We're, you know, testing a vaccine apparently as of this week. What about those other considerations, the social and economic factors? What do you think is the argument for saying we can overcome this too? Is it just a simple sunk cost fallacy?
Well, some of it is certainly a cost fallacy. Some of it is, again, getting lost in numbers and putting formulas and the quantitative over qualitative. But a lot of it, I think, also has to do with when the ball rolls down the hill and the sense, and you see it all the time, when there's a decision that has to be made and the Olympic Games and what's going on around the Olympics is big business. NBC has $8 billion of its money invested in broadcasting the Games through 2032. They turned $1 billion in ad revenue for these Games in Rio. And that's just for NBC alone. So you can imagine the money when you start to spread it out. There's a sense that when you get far down the line, you've just got to go through with it and hope to manage for the best. And I think that that's a lot of what's gone on. And there's a lot of business ethics that gets put in the mix there, not only from businesses, but certainly from government and also from nonprofit organizations that have a hand in the Olympic Games.
So let's talk about safety and security for these athletes and attendees who are going, staying in Rio during this time. What can they do?
Really, at this point, it's about knowing what to do when you're on the ground in Rio. And it's in a way that simple, but like many simple things, it's not that easy to do.
So will you be watching, maybe with one eye closed?
I'll certainly be watching.
A little nervously?
It depends. I don't know. Maybe eyes wide open on this one, but from a distance for sure.
That's Lee Eagle. He's a New York University professor. Thanks a lot for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. Always great to be with you.
Incredibly, it's not just the Zika virus, the economy, and the corruption plaguing the Olympics this year. One of the most high-profile concerns around the Games has to do with swimming, sailing, rowing, and canoeing. Water quality in Rio is a major concern for athletes who could get sick just touching or swallowing even a little bit of the water. But it's also a huge issue for Brazilians day in and day out. And the Games are just shining a light on a problem that affects cities all over the world, including here at home. Zoe Schlanger is a senior writer at Newsweek. She covers this stuff. Hi, Zoe.
Hey, Molly. How's it going?
Good. I am both sad that I am not in Brazil for the Olympics, but maybe a little relieved.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. I mean, I think people know what the deal is with the water, but what is the deal with the water? How did it get so bad?
The water there is pretty rough. About half of everything any Rio resident flushes down the toilet ends up in their waterways untreated, which is not atypical of many, many cities around the world. But the Olympics, as it tends to do, is highlighting this major issue.
But how is Brazil addressing these concerns about the safety of the water for the Olympics and, more importantly, for after the Olympics?
Yeah. So when Brazil got the Olympics, in their plan, they said they'd reduce all of the poop flowing into the waterways by about 80%. And about a year after that, they said that's just not going to happen. It's too big of a problem. They now say that's going to take about 20 years. So, you know, we're looking at like 2035, maybe there'll be less sewage in the water, but it's a huge problem for the Olympics this year. I know the AP did their own testing and found viral levels just off the charts in all of the water where Olympians will be swimming and boating, and it's about 1.7 million times what would be acceptable on a beach in, say, California. So it's pretty dirty.
Wow.
Bacterial levels are within a decent range, and that was the case until another study found a superbacteria, meaning it's not susceptible to things like antibiotics, also floating around in those waterways.
How common is this globally for water to be this dirty in major metro areas?
It's remarkably common, actually. In the developing world, especially common, about 90% of all waste ends up untreated in waterways in the developing world. But I live in New York City, where it happens here, too. Every time it rains more than a 20th of an inch, all of our sewage treatment plants become overwhelmed, and all of the waste pours directly into waterways. Not necessarily the waterways we're drinking from, which is a problem in many other places in the world, but certainly places where we could take a swim or a kayak.
Let's turn to the U.S. then, because you would think that there would be cleaner water in the U.S. To some extent there is, but we'd still have problems with water safety, even in drinking water, like the lead in Flint, of course, and some of the same issues with sewage. How bad is it here?
We really do. Flint was just in the news. Six more state officials are indicted for the lead poisoning there. And we're finding more and more that that's kind of also typical of different cities. I know that in schools, for example, lead pipes are still a major issue. So water issues as a whole in this country are pretty dire and under-talked about, for sure.
And let's talk about cost. I mean, cost is, you know, why Flint ended up in that position in the first place. But how much would it cost to fix this, maybe just in the U.S.?
In the U.S., the numbers are kind of all over the place because it depends on the city. And there's about 750 cities in the U.S. that have the same sort of, it's called combined sewage overflow problem of waste going directly into the waterways. But the EPA says around $150 billion would fix this. And the UN for the same problem says around $325 billion. So it's a range. But either way, it's about half how much we spend each year on defense, for example.
Wow, that's a big number. One imagines that maybe in a developing country or even in Brazil, where their economy has really faltered, numbers like that, assuming that they're even remotely comparable, would be sort of impossible, right?
One would think that, yeah. And there is an ongoing investigation now, actually, into where the funds to clean up the water for the Olympics went, because they had planned and allocated money to build about 8 new sewage treatment plants in Rio ahead of the Olympics, and only one got built. But either way, I mean, the country is going through tremendous political turmoil. It's hard to imagine this getting fixed anytime soon. It's also interesting just because after the Olympics is gone, Brazilians are absolutely still dealing with this. For children under 5, it's the second leading cause of death is actually contact with water and diarrhea-related diseases coming after that.
Right. And now it cannot be ignored, one would assume, after this amount of press. I mean, it's one thing to talk about Olympic sailors who have chosen to go there and compete, but it's quite another to to say that about children dying from it.
Absolutely. It's definitely interesting with the Olympics, the same thing we saw happen in Beijing with air quality. Air pollution in Beijing was off the charts. The Olympics came and people wouldn't stop talking about it. And people are still talking about Beijing air quality in a way that they hadn't been prior to 2008.
Zoe, what are some possible solutions? I mean, we're in the technological age, right? Can't we? Aren't there clever things happening out there to fix these problems with our water?
There actually are. The problem is they're quite expensive, but I don't know if you heard about this. Last year, there was this viral video of Bill Gates drinking a glass of water that had been sewage about 5 minutes before. And that's actually related to something California is trying to do right now. There's one plant that opened in 2008 that's turning sewage wastewater into potable drinking water.
Wow.
Now, the ick factor with this is enormous, and California is having a hard time getting residents to be down for the kind of toilet-to-tap concept here. But the concept is that one day we will be actually not wasting our waste, actually turning it back into potable water, kind of connecting the circle of life, if you will.
If you will. You know, you mentioned the ick factor, and yes, it is extreme. But also, we've seen such an unwillingness globally and even in America to invest in infrastructure to make these big changes. What is it going to take?
It might take looking at waste in a different way. I think that some people are trying to make the argument that there's a lot of missed economic opportunity in making water safer for people to drink. The UN put out some figures a while ago that said that every dollar put into wastewater infrastructure and efforts to make water cleaner actually puts another up to $34 into the economy by way of, let's say, health costs that were never incurred by people getting sick from their water and things of that nature. So if we could see the long-term picture, which is always difficult for governments and states and things like that, this might look like a more attractive option, actually investing on the front end and fixing the problem once and for all.
Zoe Schlinger is a senior writer at Newsweek. Thanks so much, Zoe.
Thanks, Molly.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. So we've heard so far about disease and diseased waterways, but there are still more Olympic controversies yet to explore. Golf is returning to the Summer Games after more than 100 years, but it will be back without most of its biggest names. Jordan Spieth, Jason Day, Rory McIlroy, they all bowed out, citing Zika, water quality, and scheduling issues. But all of that aside, there are other concerns about the sport's return to the Games, and they're mostly environmental. Marketplace's Andy Uhler has been following the story. He joins us now. Andy, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So am I understanding this right, that there was actually an Occupy Golf movement in Rio?
That's right. That surprised me, too. Now, it wasn't a huge movement that I noticed while I was down. I was down there a couple of years ago for the World Cup. I did actually talk to a couple of people who were trying to get to the bottom of how these organizers were going to build this course in literally an environmentally protected area. It's an area home to a bunch of rare butterflies, boa constrictors, monkeys.
I mean, they did build the course, though, right? How were they allowed to get that done?
So one of the arguments that they were kind of putting forward was that the area had already been victim to a lot of resource exploitation. So it was a lot of illegal sand mining. So the dunes had been taken out by that. And again, it seems like that was where they were kind of stemming to say, look, what we're going to do is restore the area. We're going to create the sustainability plan. And then there was talk of we're going to plant all these different seedlings and it's going to be all, you know, all great and all natural. So I spoke with Tanya Braga from Rio. She said she was pretty busy this week. She gave me a couple of minutes on the phone. Now, she's the head of sustainability, accessibility, and legacy for the Rio 2016 organizing committee. She said they actually sent out a legal expert and was sent by the Brazilian DA's office. And came back and said, look, there was no damage and no degradation from the building of this course.
On the contrary, the golf course is a successful experience of environmental restoration and is helping the biodiversity in the surrounding area.
Now, I think, Molly, you should probably take this with a grain of salt. It sounds great, and I'm not here to accuse anybody of anything, but Brazil is still pretty rampant with corruption. I mean, we have Petrobras, you know, happening still. And, you know, someone sent by the DA or by the mayor's office, it's hard to tell how kind of independent third party that person might be. Now, some of the protesters are also arguing that government officials are probably seeing some of the benefits from these developers. I know there are big donations being made to campaigns from developers, and now there are condos and luxury apartments being built kind of around the course. So, of course, the folks in Rio are going to tell you, look, there was no degradation. It was great, and we're doing all these things. But again, take it, I think, with a grain of salt.
Well, and then here's the real question. Was it even necessary to build the course at all?
That's the question that I kept reading about and I kept asking too. Rio has two golf courses, and actually the owner of one of the courses said he wrote the International Olympic Committee a letter and never heard back. Now, the other angle here is he might have been asking for millions of dollars to repair the course or make it better, because that it would have cost some money to have manicured it for the Olympics. But the construction for this wasn't cheap either. It was more than $60 million. And that's another thing that Rio points out, is that all the funding, though, was put through a public-private partnership. And actually, the developer footed the bill for most of that and then subsequently was able to build those apartments and luxury kind of condos that I was telling you about.
So then, and this is always the question with Olympic installations,
sure.
What happens to this golf course after the games are over?
Yeah, no, that was pretty interesting to me, too. It's going to be one of Brazil's only public golf courses. I think there are only two other ones in the country, maybe even just one other one. So anyone can play the course, which organizers like to tell you. But I talked with David Good, who is a doctor at the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University. He says more than environmental problem, this could actually end up being a social and class issue, which I thought was interesting. He said most of the people who will be using the space are wealthy Rio elite.
When you look at the Olympic Charter, one of the missions is to provide a lasting legacy. And there are parts that do that, like the transportation improvements, are really going to have a nice positive legacy for Rio. But this is probably the black eye. It's a conversion of natural public space into what's likely to be much more private, restricted use.
He said that conversion of natural land to this sort of kind of exclusive land use is something we should keep an eye on in Rio, you know, even after the game. The games are 2 weeks, so we got a lot of kind of fallout from what's going to happen.
That's Marketplace's Andy Euler. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Molly.
Fun fact, rugby is also returning to the Olympics for the first time since 1924, and women's rugby will be featured for the first time. There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. We are pretty into the numbers here at Marketplace. Maybe you've noticed. That's why every week we tell you about some of the biggest ones in the world of business. Here are Marketplace's Tony Wagner and Donna Tam with this week's news by the numbers. Take it, Tony.
Thanks, Molly. Our first number is
$1.2 billion.
That's NBC's total ad sales for the Rio Games.
That price tag includes digital ads, cable, and broadcast. The company is airing 6,700 hours of total coverage.
In 2011, NBC Universal shelled out $4.4 billion for broadcast rights to the Olympics from 2014 to 2020.
And then in 2014, they paid $7.65 billion to extend those rights for another 18 years. You got all that?
7.5 million.
That's how many tickets are available for the games, half of them priced at or under 70 Brazilian reals, or about $30.
Don't expect that kind of deal at the opening ceremony, though. The cheapest tickets on StubHub last weekend cost thousands.
$12 billion.
That's the estimated bill for putting on the games, but it could end up climbing much, much higher.
Although there are plans to reuse all those new facilities, many are worried they'll waste away after the games are over.
Might not be the best situation for a country that's mired in recession, disease, and political turmoil.
Good times.
Now it's time for the Marketplace Quiz. That's when we bring in musicians, writers, and this week, surprise, surprise, an athlete. We ask them questions about work and money and how it shaped their lives or taught them important lessons, or in this case, how it paved their road to Rio to compete in the Olympic Games. Here's our producer, Eliza Mills, with this week's guest.
My name is Sam Mikulic, and I'm an Olympic gymnast.
Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you
toys. Right now, I've got an obsession with Pokemon and Legos and bubbles, actually, and street chalk.
What do you do with that stuff?
I don't know. I just want to be a kid again kind of thing. So it's like just going back to my childhood days and making sure that I'm having fun with how much stress I have every single day in the gym. You know, you need a little time to get out and, you know, just be whoever you want to be.
In a next life, what would your career be?
Ooh, I would probably do beach volleyball. Even though it's a sport, I feel like I can't steer away from athletics. But I'm just too short in this life, and I'm hoping in my next one I'll be taller.
What's something that you bought that you now completely regret buying?
I bought the... a Fitbit, actually. And I thought it was going to be an awesome way to track how I live and move and burn calories, but with gymnastics, it was just a total waste of money because it's like more based off how you walk and not how you flip.
When did you realize gymnastics could be your career?
The first time I won a medal in the all-around competition was when I realized that's what I wanted to do pretty much for the rest of my life, even though I was still doing baseball and soccer at the time. I think I just found that that was more my passion, where I saw a lot more success. I was probably 8 or 9 years old.
That's so young. Did you know already that it was something that you could make money doing?
It wasn't about money ever, especially when you're 9 years old. It's all about what you find is more fun and where your passion lies.
What is your most prized possession?
Ooh, my most prized possession is my pillow. I can't travel or like sleep without it. And it's like this really thin down pillow that really doesn't do anything, but it's weird. If I just don't have it, I'm constantly thinking about not having it.
My next question for you is, what was your first job? But you've been doing this since you were 2. Have you ever had another job?
Nope. This has been my one and only.
What's something that everyone should own no matter how much it costs?
Something everyone should own. In a way, I think the only thing you should own is a toothbrush. That seems to be like the one necessity that you should never go without.
Spoken by someone who is always on the move. Do you remember the first thing that you bought with money that you made as a gymnast?
I've just been saving my money quite a bit. I want to open up a gym in Southern California so I can train there for the next 4 years of my life. Pretty much everything I'm making, I want to just kind of put in my bank and hopefully make that dream come true.
What's the hardest part of your job that no one knows about?
The hardest part is, you know, we do a lot of conditioning, we do a lot of routines that are endurance, but I think it's like growing your willpower, which is really the hardest part, and pushing yourself beyond your own expectations and the expectations of everyone around you, and making sure that you're the first one in the gym and the last one out, and that when you can go to a competition, you can look back and say that you've done everything in your power to be as good as you possibly can for this one moment.
Good luck to Sam Mikulik and the rest of Team USA in Rio. On with our Olympic show, let's talk technology for a bit. Sports and tech are pretty much indistinguishable these days as athletes look for any edge to buy them crucial milliseconds, strength, or recovery from injury. The Olympic Games are often a showcase for sports tech that eventually trickles down to the rest of us, like that Kinesio tape that everybody was wearing in 2012, or those Speedo fast skin swimsuits that Michael Phelps wore, and now you can buy yourself. This year's no different, so for more on the gear and gadgets of the Games, we turn to Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Molly.
Okay, let's geek out about tech in the Olympics, because every year it gets crazier and crazier. This year, it sounds like wearables have taken over, and there are lots of them. Tell me about these.
Yeah, so it's getting pretty crazy in the wearable world. The USA cycling team has been wearing augmented reality glasses to train, called Solos. No, not Google Glass, Molly. That's
dangerous.
And thank goodness. The glasses have these interesting displays in them that are connected wirelessly to these sensors on the bikes themselves. And they measure things like pedal revolution, speed, power. They won't be able to wear these glasses during the races, but during training, this kind of real-time data feed, which a lot of these wearable things are doing now, really helps athletes pace themselves and be sure that they're hitting their marks. A lot of athletes and coaches are doing this kind of thing, you know, across the games before the start gun goes off, as it were, training, monitoring data in real time ahead of the competition itself. I'm sure you've seen these like photos of runners on the treadmills with these crazy breathing devices and things attached to their arms, measuring their heart rate and things like that. So there's a lot of wearable stuff going on.
Yeah, not a single Apple Watch that I can see, but I have seen these nubby fabrics. What's that all about?
Technical term, nubby fabrics. Nike has this new textile tech called Aeroblade, which is pretty cool, both in shorts and shirts of some Olympians, but also these, like, you know, those like tape strips that you athletes sometimes put on their body. This fabric has all these little nodes on them. They look like teeny tiny little shark's teeth. And Nike says that the U.S., Brazil, Germany, and China track and field teams will be wearing this stuff for the first time at the games. They're supposed to cut down on wind drag. So they're supposed to basically shave tenths of seconds off of times for some of the Olympians. It'll be hard to see no matter how high def your television is, but it's designed to reduce drag. And Nike also says the technology is manufactured from recycled polyester. So, you know, little recycling karma there. That's good for athletes, I suppose.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about one of the companies. I know that Visa is one of the official sponsors in Rio. I'm not trying to give them a shout out here, but I know they're giving players these special payment rings, like payment wearables. Other technology I want to see trickle down, by the way.
Yeah, me too. You know, it's tough. You're in the Olympic Village. You need to buy an I Just Want a Gold Medal beer, and your wallet doesn't fit into your spandex. We've all had this problem, right?
Yeah.
But Visa has this ring. It's giving Olympians that looks actually pretty interesting. It has a microchip in it from Gemalto, that company, and an antenna. The coolest thing about this ring may be that it doesn't need to be charged. It's low power. It gets its charge from the terminal where you pay for something. It takes charge from that. You can't buy this ring as a consumer yet. It doesn't really have an official name, but these Olympics are supposedly a testing ground for it. So if it works well, maybe we'll be able to buy them before, I don't know, Tokyo's games in 2020.
That's like the most devious gamification I think I've ever heard. Okay.
Right.
There is so much tech in those games. Let's keep this ball rolling. Let's talk about how we're going to watch this year, because even that is all digital and new.
Yeah. You're into virtual reality, right? Just like me?
Yeah. As much as any alpha geek.
The good news first, the Olympics in Rio will be programming supposedly 85 hours of games and events in virtual reality. So they'll have these cameras. It won't be like real VR, but it'll be immersive 360-degree video, as they call it. Mm-hmm. You might not get to throw a javelin, but you might get real close to one. The bad news is you probably can't watch this stuff without some pretty specific tech. It looks like in the U.S., this stuff will only be available if you download the NBC Sports app and have a Samsung Galaxy phone and also a Samsung Gear VR headset. So it'll be a little bit tough.
I mean, the Olympics really do, in a weird way, pioneer a lot of technology. And so I'm wondering if you have a favorite. Do you have a favorite Olympics innovation?
Okay. So this thing is called the Twins Cam. And it was around in the 2012 Olympics, but I hope I'll get to see a lot more of it this year. I'm so into this. This is kind of this weird two-camera setup that allows you to watch swimming events in a kind of split screen above and below the water. Do you know what I'm talking about? That kind of like really interesting split screen. I love it so much. I don't know why. It's just like really cool. And it was invented by Japanese broadcaster NHK back in 2010. It's this simple idea that solves a difficult problem, right? The problem is that there's crazy light refraction and reflection that happens when you're filming above and below water. And so the solution here for the Twins Cam is it's basically two lensed cameras that move together almost like synchronized swimmers, Molly. And they combine their feeds, after taking their shots so that it looks like one shot. It is magic and I love it. And I want to see it all the time.
And that is Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and Alpha Geek. Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you, Molly.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend as we continue our exploration of all things Olympic. In this week's episode, let's move to a trend that is apparently as old as the games themselves: financial corruption. Bribery, to put a fine point on it. In the case of Rio, there are allegations that lawmakers might have taken bribes to assign lucrative construction contracts for the venues for the games. There are plenty of other financial shenanigans at work, too. But according to Nigel Crowther, professor of classical studies at the University of Western Ontario, bribes have been part of the game since ancient Greece.
Well, it started in one of the founding myths of the Olympic Games when one of the local kings of the area, known as Pelops, bribed the charioteer of one of his rivals so that he could win the local princess. And that, I think, to a modern audience is a little strange, that this idea of corruption should appear in one of the very founding myths of the Olympic Games.
Well, and it seems like ever since that time, too, then there were bribes for just about everything. Athletes throwing competitions, judges. I mean, how rampant was this even in ancient history?
It's difficult to tell how rampant it was because we only have little bits and pieces here and there. But if we put it together, we can find several different layers of bribery. One of them is that athletes bribed athletes. Say in boxing or running, somebody who was fairly rich and willing to break the rules, one athlete would bribe another athlete to win. It happened in boxing. It also happened in judging when some of the judges were a little bit, shall we say, not as impartial as they should be and favored their hometown athletes. And bribery was really part of the ancient world, unlike in the modern world. I don't think we get many examples today of athletes bribing athletes as we did in the ancient world.
How do you think that these games compare to previous times in terms of the level of corruption or scandal?
I think that remains to be seen. As far as I can tell, the level of corruption seems to be in Rio itself, not so much in the bidding process, although it was there, but it seems to be in the building process, the construction of the infrastructure, and that sort of thing. A little bit early to tell, but nothing like 2002.
One of the things that bothers people about the Olympics when they want to love it so much is this idea of sort of cheating. And you point out that that has been part of the history of the games ever since the beginning. Should we just accept that as part of the Olympics?
I think this is a very important question because it revolves around the idea of competition. And I think where there's competition, then there are going to be problems because it's the idea of winning at all costs. If we go back to ancient Greece, what we find is this, that the Olympic Games were not known in ancient Greek as Olympic Games. They were Olympic competitions. And therefore, this idea of contest invites, as it were, winning. And of course, many people are going to win at all costs. And they're going to win at all costs because there are so many rewards, so much honor, so much glory, and eventually there are financial rewards. And I also want to emphasize that the spirit of competition, which is known as the agon in ancient Greece, this spirit of competition was part of everyday society. So it was a very competitive society, and this is something that distinguished it from other societies around the Mediterranean and elsewhere in the world. The agon, the spirit of competition, was found in all levels of life, and therefore we see it to a great extent, of course, in sport.
That's Nigel Crowther, professor at the University of Western Ontario. Thank you so much for your perspective.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
That's our show for this week. Lizzie will be back next week as we continue our conversation about how you balance your personal time with your work time, or how maybe you don't. Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page. You'll find us by searching for Marketplace Business News, or you can call us 1-800-648-5114, and your voice may be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend was produced this week from the Reveal Studios at the Center for Investigative Reporting. It's also produced by Eliza Mills and Raghu Manavalan. Raghu, I should note, is moving over to Marketplace's election project for the next several months. We know he's going to do amazing work over there. You will still hear Raghu quizzing celebs for the Marketplace quiz now and then, so look forward to that. Dan Simatovich is our senior producer. Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer, and Deborah Clark is our vice president. I am Molly Wood. This is APM.